like to begin by thanking Magnus Bernardsson and for inviting me here, and Jim O'Brien for arranging, making the arrangements for travel and the hotel. It's really great to be around you. I am actually coming from the imperial capital of the world, and where policy speaks, sort of dominates everything. And it's so nice to be in a place where the language of discourse or is so different. So I had hoped to talk to you today about the most urgent humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the Iraq war, which is the refugee crisis. But found out that it's going to be very hard for me to talk to you about refugees and explain to you about Iraq, or explain Iraq to you in 30 minutes. So what I'd like to do is actually talk about Iraq, and then I hope that we can raise the refugee issue later on. I've been studying Iraq for about 22 years now, and often find myself at a loss to explain the killing fields that are Iraq right now. And I suspect a number of journalists and pundits also are as confused as I am, as they hold course on the culture and society and politics of Iraq. But it seems to me, however, that they have accepted with disconcerting alacrity a set of explanations and misconceptions of Iraq that have become enshrined as truth. And it has been that the consequences of these misconceptions have been disastrous to Iraqis. I should say at the outset that I'm going to limit my talk to discussing or talking about Arab Iraq. The Kurdish part of Iraq, or Iraqi Kurdistan, has had a totally different trajectory in the past 17 years. So let me go back to these misconceptions. I think the first of these misconceptions is that Iraq is made up of hostile sects, the Shiites, the majority of the population, and the Sunnis, who have been in conflict since the dawn of Islam in the 7th century. So if you know the difference between a Shia and a Sunni at the beginning of Islam, somehow that is supposed to explain to you what's happening in Iraq right now. Modern Iraq, they argue, was created by the British in 1921. And the British brought together these groups in an uneasy alliance that gave preference to one sect, the Sunnis, over the other. From then on, Iraq has been a state dominated by Sunnis at the expense of Shiites, who were the oppressed majority. The U.S. occupation, according to this logic, and the desire to bring democracy to Iraq was really an attempt to address this imbalance between the numerical strength of the majority and its political power. But these good intentions backfired or were derailed by U.S. mismanagement and irreconcilable divisions between these communities with ancient hatred. Despite their differences, proposed solutions by the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, taken for granted the Iraqi society is hopelessly divided along sectarian lines, and one of the solutions being proposed, and proposed quite seriously, is to divide Iraq, sometimes a hard division, sometimes a soft division, under the rubric of federalism of some sort. Now, the second misconception that pervades the punditry and shapes U.S. policy in Iraq is the belief that Iraqi society is made up of tribes with tribal allegiances that are not conducive to stable democratic politics. The impression one gets from reading about Iraq these days is that it's not a modern society with a professional middle class, a working class, and a functioning institutions and labor movement and professional unions. As a result, U.S. political and military policy has sought to arm and empower what they call tribes to fight insurgency, police urban districts, and run local councils. This is a policy that has done much to further destabilize Iraq and ultimately increase the divisions within society. What I'd like to argue today is that sectarian violence and tribal politics in Iraq are relatively recent developments. That is to say, Iraqis have not in the past killed each other over sectarian identity, nor have they, for the most part, organized into political parties based on their communal affiliation. And although tribal identity has played an important part in Iraq in the early period of the formation of Iraq, it had become completely irrelevant by the 1950s. So the question that begs an answer is why they are so prominent now in Iraqi politics. And I think the answer lies in three things. It's war, particularly the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War in 2003. The second, the sanctions regime that was imposed on Iraq between 1991 and 2003. And the political choices that the rulers of Iraq, whether we're talking about the Saddam period and this period, or the post-Saddam period, chose to manage violence in Iraq. People often forget that Iraqis have been at war continuously nearly for 27 years. The United States has been involved in war with Iraq for 17 of these 27 years. From 1980 to 1988, Iraqis fought a long war of attrition with Iran. More than 800,000 Iraqi men died in this war. That's about 4% of the population. In U.S. terms, it's as if the U.S. lost roughly 9.5 million soldiers in Vietnam. Less than 2 years later, after the conclusion of the Iraq-Iran War, Iraq invaded Kuwait. The Gulf War that ensued created a coalition of 30 states and wreaked more devastation and destruction in Iraq, on Iraq in 45 days than Iraq had experienced in its 8 years of war. In addition, another 2% of the Iraqi population, this time including women and children, died as a result of the war and as a result of the suppression of the insurrection that, among Iraqis that came after the war. For American soldiers who came home after the first Gulf War and after Kuwait was liberated, the war was over. But for the Iraqis who stayed in Iraq, the war was far from over. 12 years of punishing sanctions imposed by the UN and vociferously supported by both the Clinton and Bush administrations, in addition to periodic bombing of Iraq, convinced the Iraqis that sanctions was war by other means. The result was a general pauperization of the Iraqi population, countless deaths of children from malnutrition and lack of sanitation and medication, and the gradual dismantling of the educational and social institutions that supported Iraqis. But I think, that is made clear, we need to focus on the policies as well of Saddam Hussein during this period. To survive, the Saddam Hussein regime of the 90s and until 2003, together with the insistence of the United States of continuing the sanctions and its attempt to topple Saddam, provide the background for what happens after 2003. But the 2003 occupation and the post-Saddam era reinforced divisions among Iraqi society, and enshrined these divisions in a set of legal and administrative measures that threatened to make them irreversible. It is ironic in some ways, as I will show presently, that the policies now followed, pushed by the surge under the guise of counterinsurgency, as well as the policies pursued by the Maliki government, the current government of Iraq, reproduce in many ways the politics followed by Saddam in the last decade of his rule. Let me start with Saddam's policies. Saddam Hussein became the president of Iraq and the head of the Ba'ath Party in 1979, eventually became head of the prime minister and the head of the armed forces. Iraq in the 1980s was a single-party dictatorship similar to what existed in Eastern Germany and the Soviet Union. The Iran-Iraq War was a conventional war of two modern third world countries. The leadership of Iraq mobilized all sectors of society to fight in the war. Iraqi soldiers came from all backgrounds in Iraq. They were from the middle class, writers, journalists, artists, as well as from working class and peasant families. They came from all regions of Iraq, from all clans and sects. I spent the summer interviewing veterans of this war who came from all these backgrounds. They all spoke of their hatred of the war, but genuinely believed that they were defending their country from being taken over by Iran and becoming an Islamic Republic. Now, the Iraqi government mobilized party-controlled popular organizations, the labor union, remember this is a one-party state, the professional unions, and the Federation of Iraqi Women to help in support of the war. Popular civil defense committees, a popular army made of men and women, was active throughout the war. In addition to fighting on the front, men and women on the home front were asked to participate in extensive literacy campaigns in the countryside. And women were trained to replace men in factories and on farms. The war was marketed by the Iraqi government as a war between a modern state, which was engaged in building a modern society, against a medieval and backward-looking state that wanted to resurrect the past. It was also marketed as a war between heroic Arabs and weak and treacherous Persians. In other words, it was marketed as a national war with racial overtones. Religion played very little role in the propaganda for the war. The majority of Iraqis were not happy with the war, but they went along. Those who opposed the war were branded traitors and agents of foreign power. They were imprisoned, executed, or exiled. Some communities became victims of collective punishment by the state because their loyalty was questioned. Among them were Shiite communities who lived on the borders with Iran, as well as Kurdish communities. In northern Iraq, the end of the war saw an ethnic cleansing of hundreds of thousands of Kurds and displacement. Outside of these examples, the systematic liquidation of Shiite communities based on sectarian identity was not a policy pursued by the Ba'ath in the 1980s. What concerned the Ba'athist state most was the disobedience of the state and the party, desertion from the army or criticism of the leader, all crimes punishable by imprisonment or death. In other words, the Ba'athist party and the leadership of the Ba'ath was an equal opportunity oppressor, particularly when we're talking about the Arabs. It was avowedly secular and national in its politics and thought that they were, that any party of or group that threatened the division of Iraq deserved to be punished. This changes with the Gulf War. The first Gulf War began to change the way Saddam governs in Iraq. Iraqi government policies turned to tribalism, corruption, favoritism, and religion to build up its weakening hold over the Iraqi population. Remember, this is a semi-fascist state. Regime survival becomes essential in any measures, regardless of ideological commitments that are necessary to make that regime survive, are undertaken. What happens after the first Gulf War is a general breakdown of armed services and the Ba'ath party membership. The second thing that happens is the state of constant war by the international community headed by the United States and Britain in the form of economic sanctions and selective bombing. In each case, the responses of the Iraqi government to these problems created havoc in Iraqi society. The breakdown of the political and military system came soon after the signing of the ceasefire agreement on February 28, 1991. Retreating army units initiated a general uprising that began in the southern city of Basra and eventually came to encompass 15 out of the 18 provinces of Iraq. The 3 weeks that ensued were bloody and chaotic. The uprising was fueled by anger at the government for taking Iraq into a heated war, at the Ba'ath party for squandering the resources of Iraq, and the leadership of the country for abandoning the Iraqi army to its fate in Kuwait. The uprising was brutally suppressed by Saddam's security forces and the Republican Guard. It was clear to the leadership, however, that the army and the party had been irrevocably damaged. Under Saddam Hussein's guidance, the leadership devised a strategy that created alternative political and military organizations to protect the regime and keep its hold over the country. These organizations cut across sectarian lines. They also transformed the political culture of Iraq from a modern one-party system to a more traditional system of government, similar in some ways to the more traditional Gulf tribe-based governments. Let me give you some examples of these organizations that have continued to have an impact now on Iraq, although they've taken different guises. The first was the organization called the Friends of Saddam. The organization was created in 1992. The Friends of Saddam were card-carrying members of an organization that would eventually encompass some 12 to 14% of the population of Iraq. It drew its membership from all regions of Iraq, outside the autonomous Kurdish region at that moment, and cut across ethnic and sectarian lines. Your reward, if you were a friend of Saddam, was you got access to property, you got access to jobs, and you got also some a monthly stipend. What happens is that this weakened the Baath Party. Citizenship in this new setup was not defined by membership to the Baath Party. It was, if at all, but loyalty to the leader. The result of this policy is that we have now a culture of corruption and personalized politics that remains endemic to Iraq. The second organization was the tribal councils that were set up in Iraq, and tribal leaders in southern and central Iraq had supported the regime in the 1991 uprising against what was at that time really an urban uprising. So Saddam Hussein began to actually reward them by giving them land, giving them trade licenses, and also giving them access to property. And the joke among the large number of Iraqis I interviewed, particularly the intellectuals, the urban intellectuals I interviewed this summer, is if you had forgotten about your tribe, or if you had no tribe, you invented one. And so all of a sudden, a large number of Iraqis began remembering their tribal roots and taking on their tribal names. So, you know, the tribes were invented for very, very, very smart political reasons. Now, the ultimate example of how far tribalism had become part of the Iraqi fabric of society in the 1990s was that Saddam issued a directive to allow honor killing of a woman suspected of adultery by her tribe, a practice that had never been law in Iraq. A number of these tribal leaders, first in Anbar and the other provinces, and now all over the southern and central areas of Iraq, are heads of what are known as the Tribal Iraqi Awakening Council. Councils that are being touted by the Bush administration and by Petraeus as being the great progress in the insurgency, in the counterinsurgency development. Now, the other thing that happens in Iraq at this period is the creation of paramilitary organizations. The army has been completely devastated, so Saddam and the leadership create paramilitary organizations known as Fida'een Saddam, as well as the Quds Brigade. And these paramilitary organizations don't come only from Sunnis, which is now what is being touted, but come from really poor and disenfranchised youth. They come from the poorer classes in Iraq that were losing opportunities because of the sanctions and because of the economic hardship. And they become a paramilitary organizations, and a large number of them eventually join the insurgency, the Sunni insurgency, as well as the Mahdi army. But before 2003, they were not divided against along sectarian lines. They were basically Fida'i Saddam. They were paid by Saddam and by the person who ran them, one of Saddam's children. Finally, one of the effective political strategies used by the ruling clique around Saddam was favoritism. And I don't mean only favoritism to his clan and to his area, but favoritism to those areas in Iraq that had not rebelled in 1991. So the issue of violence and who rebelled was crucial. And so these areas, which are now known as the Sunni Triangle, were favored with investments in a time of scarce resources at the expense of southern regions. And so you see a lot of the tension that we see in Iraq now between what is seen as Sunni versus Shia can really be explained in terms of regional tensions between what is known, what is felt by southerners who feel that they've been disenfranchised by the former regime against people who had been favored in the north. So it's not really along Sunni Shia lines alone, but also around these regional lines in Iraq. Now, I think, however, we will not begin to understand the profound changes and catastrophic deterioration of the quality of life of ordinary Iraqis without coming to grips with the sanctions regime. By 2003, more UN resolutions on sanctions on Iraq have been drafted on any other topic. I mean, you know, it's a full-time job. 16 million Iraqis, nearly 80% of the population, survived on food rations of 50 cents a day in a country which had one of the highest food consumption rates in the region. Sanitation, access to water, and medical care suffered. Most of the lower middle class and middle class refugees I interviewed this summer had young children born in this time who had developed something called the syndrome called failure to thrive. They were undernourished and had below average growth rates. A 2004 UNICEF study reports that the sanctions have also weakened the educational institutions because of lack of books and resources. Students cut classes to find work to support their family. There was a drastic decline in literacy rates in both rural and urban areas. Now, there's a lot of statistics on the impact of sanctions that have become very politicized in the 90s, so I will not burden you with this. What concerns me here is a couple of developments that also we see factoring and make us understand what's happening in Iraq right now. First of all, one of the first problems they faced was rampant unemployment and underemployment. Together with the decline in education, the young generation of Iraq found itself unmoored with no direction or help. There was a spike in crime levels of all kinds in Iraq, including increase in prostitution. To combat this trend and help control the population at a time when ideology of the ruling party had become devoid of any meaning, the leadership, particularly Saddam Hussein, initiated an Islamization campaign that had far-reaching consequences and we're only now beginning to see. To see its impact. Students in elementary school and secondary schools were now taught an hour of Quran in every memorization each day. An Islamic university was founded. Mosques became the centers for distribution of food and goods as well as a meeting place, particularly in a poorer neighborhood. Periodic raids against places of drinking and nightclubs were initiated. For the first time in Iraqi history, these hands were cut off for the crime of theft. Prostitutes were executed. The Federation of Iraqi Women, which had spearheaded a sort of a rosy derivative culture during the Iran-Iraq War, now urged women to stay at home, learn how to economize and running their households, and begin recycling old clothes. The Ministry of Religious Affairs became a powerful ally to the regime. A large number of Iraqis turned to religion for solace in the desperate and difficult time. For many, particularly in the southern regions of Iraq that had suffered greatly during the first Gulf War, belief in apocalyptic visions of destruction and renewal were fueled by the experience of the U.S. bombing and the coming of the end of days. This is a trope that was continuously brought up in my interviews of veterans and survivors of the 91 war. The power of the new technologies of war was so overwhelming for the people on receiving the end of them that they could only understand them in these terms and explain them in these terms. So what this state-sponsored as well as community-based turn to religion amounted to was an Islamization of a society that had been largely secular at that point, till that time. So the policies of Saddam Hussein were, you know, led to this de-tribalization, the emergence of religious identities, and the use of religion as an expression, as an idiom for political organization that we see developing in Iraq right now. But nothing at that time would have made what we, the sectarian violence of Iraq that we see now, inevitable. It was foreseeable, but it was not inevitable. And it is here that really U.S. policy has been instrumental in creating this civil war, this sectarian civil war, and even this violence among warlords in Iraq. And I want, there's been much that's been written about how the United States government messed up and how, I think the best one is, I think, Imperial Life in the Emerald Cities. It's a great book to read on this. And there are also more technical books. But I think there are a couple of two or three things that actually factor into the persistence of the violence that we see in Iraq. First of all, the secular opposition is the choice of the American in the 90s and before 2003, the choice of opposition parties that they decided were the opposition parties that they were going to support. The secular opposition parties in or groups were corrupt in Iraq. That were outside Iraq were corrupt, divided, and had no following whatsoever by the 1990s in Iraq. They had left Iraq in the 70s and 80s and had no idea what the situation was on the ground by the 90s. And the religious opposition parties that were based in Iran in the 1990s were armed and functioned and funded by Iran. Their agenda, particularly that of the ruling Dawah party right now and the Shi'i Council of Islamic Revolution, now it's something else, it's called the Islamic Supreme Council in Iraq, were openly sectarian. They had power because they had militias, and they were allowed into Iraq by the Americans after 2003. In addition, Bremen and the Coalition Provisional Authority, which governed Iraq until 2004, chose to follow an ill-advised policy of de-ratification. And this is that not only did they disband the army, but also the whole administrative structure and the whole Iraqi state. And not only does it fuel the insurgency and basically effectively took out of the job market the people who were most qualified to run Iraq, it also was really quite problematic. The Ba'ath Party had become meaningless. Belonging to the Ba'ath Party by the 1990s had become meaningless. Everybody in Iraq, like everybody in Eastern Europe or Eastern European countries, was compromised. This is the only way one could survive. You had to belong to the Iraqi, to the Ba'ath Party. Now, even the constitution, finally, which is often touted as the most positive result of the occupation, which was the constitution, is problematic. It did allow for federalism and protected individual rights, but the underlying working assumption was proportional representation based on religious and ethnic communities. Even this promise of federalism is shaky as parties within Iraq are working with the support of members of Congress on the idea of soft partition of Iraq along sectarian lines. The south is to become Shi'i, the north is to become Sunni, the central parts and parts of the north become Sunni, and the Kurds would have the canton. The majority of Iraqis oppose this kind of federalism, although they do want some decentralized rule in Iraq, and I'll be happy to talk about this some more. And there are indications that some of the Iraqis are coming together from all sects and communities are coming together to oppose this plan for partition. All of this, I think, the US support of sectarian parties and the wrong kind of leaders in Iraq plays and continues to play an important role. But I think that at this point, what we are seeing is beyond the control of the US and has acquired momentum of its own. Civil wars produce their own politics and their own economic systems, and these have a snowball effect. I'm Lebanese and I lived through some of the civil war, and this comes not only from studies of places like Kosovo and Bosnia, but also from seeing this on the ground. There's an economic and political logic behind all of this. What we are seeing is the formation of many states controlled by warlords. The economies of these states are already run by militias who provide protection, tax, or export the population, or extort the population, provide jobs, and guarantee access. The map of Iraq is being drawn by these militias to accommodate their political needs. Neither the Shi'is nor the Sunnis are divided, are united in Iraq, and in fact, a great deal of the struggle and the violence we see in Iraq right now between what's supposed to be government troops and the Sadr militia is in many ways a struggle between a Shia militia associated with the government and the Sadr, the Mahdi army, who want control over access of oil and resources. So what we're talking about is inter-warlords really fighting each other over the spoils. And I think what I'll do is conclude this section because I think I'm running out of time, I think. I'll conclude this section by giving you sort of something I read in the Guardian on March 24th. The United States government and the Iraqi government has been funding these militias in Iraq, these tribal militias in Iraq, and now we have they're not only in Anbar province, but they're in 11 provinces in Iraq. And in what surely must be the best indication of the kind of economy of violence that exists in Iraq right now, several awakening council members in central Iraq have threatened to go on strike because they have not received their salaries in 2 months. I guess this is the kind of labor activism that exists in Iraq right now. It's really ironic. So let me conclude by saying that by actually saying a few words about the refugee problem in Iraq, and I want to conclude with a story of a family that I met this summer in Jordan. I have tried to prove to you that, or argue to you, that sectarianism is relative to reason, that as is tribalism. Whether they're reversible right now depends on a large number of things that are extremely tenuous. But I think what we need to deal with and what we need to keep remembering is the responsibility of the United States is not to remove its troops from Iraq. The United States and the international community, all the Iraqis and the Iraqi people, a responsibility to rebuild their community and bring them together in a viable and stable state. And the problems that have been created by the war are particularly evident in the catastrophe of the refugees in Iraq. There are 4 million refugees in Iraq, those of you who've been following the news anyway. 2 million are internally displaced within Iraq itself, and 2 million are distributed between Syria and Jordan. There's some in Egypt and some in Lebanon. And I think there needs to be some sort of serious thinking on how to deal with this situation. And this is the most problematic refugee issue that the Middle East had to deal with since the 1948 Palestinian refugee crisis. But unlike the Palestinian refugee crisis, the refugees in Iraq, the Iraqi refugees live within the communities they become refugees in. That is to say, they're not in camps, they're not taken care of by the United Nations. They have a very, very precarious existence. And I want to conclude with the story of Umm Saif and her family, who I met in Jordan during a research trip this summer, because her story actually provides a window on the precarious world of these refugees. Umm Saif lives with her 5 children and her husband in a small two-room apartment in one of the poor neighborhoods of East Amman, on the outskirts of a Palestinian refugee camp. She had been an elementary school art teacher before she fled Iraq in 2005. Her husband had fought in the Iran-Iraq War as well as in the Gulf War and had decided to quit the army after the debacle of the first Gulf War. In Amman, they are rarely able to feed their 5 children and are unable to work because they do not have legal residency visas. To feed the family, Umm Saif often takes the job of cleaning houses of wealthy Iraqis, acting as a server in dinner parties, or doing odd jobs. Often, her employers do not pay her what they had promised her, and she has no legal recourse. When she or her family gets sick, she has to depend on the charitable donations of family and other non-profit organizations. Her husband cannot work because the Jordanian police often pick up Iraqi men who are suspected of being illegal. He sits at home waiting for an odd job, a handsome man with quiet dignity. He has been recruited twice to be an extra in American movies about Iraq, the last one being Brian De Palma's Redacted. He sees the irony of all of this. When I asked him how he felt about acting in a movie by a famous director, he said he would much rather there were no movies at all about Iraq. Then he shook his head and said something that many Iraqis I interviewed repeated: why is this happening to us? Thanks for your attention.